This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 16th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. China and Russia have decided it's strategically in their best interest to be friends again. Florida's Supreme Court agrees that state funding should not cover abortions for women on Medicaid. And a California judge gives the nod to put the Oakland Raiders police squad on trial. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The World Climate Conference is underway in Bonn, Germany, where 150 nations plan to work on the final ratification of the Kyoto Agreement, which seeks to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Since the Bush administration has unilaterally decided to ignore the agreement, saying it's too harsh on developed nations, environmentalists are now concerned the protocol might be watered down at the conference. Charles Michael Ray reports from Bonn.
A critical mass bicycle ride of about 300 people started off a series of demonstrations that are taking place at the World Climate Conference in Bonn. Hanno Rosendorf is the spokesperson for Rising Tide, a German group that is organizing a counter-conference, several workshops, and actions during the two-week climate meeting. Rosendorf says the corporate loopholes being put in the Kyoto Protocol will make it an extension of neocolonialism.
We don't want to have the flexible mechanisms integrated into the Kyoto Protocol. That means no clean development mechanism, no joint implementation, and above all, no trade of emission rights. This is very important because these mechanisms create far more problems than they solve.
Rosendorf goes on to say that CO2 sinks should not be allowed to be used as a substitute for emissions reductions. Rising Tide is calling for a worldwide reduction of 60% in CO2 emissions rather than the 5.2% in the Kyoto Protocol. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Bonn.
President Bush is considering granting an estimated 3 million undocumented Mexicans legal residence in the United States. Ravi D'Souza has more from the White House.
The Bush administration is considering a possible grant of amnesty for the nearly 3 million illegal Mexican immigrants in the United States. The state and Justice Departments are part of an immigration task force that has been appointed to address the issue. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer noted that granting these immigrants amnesty would be in standing with America's multi-ethnic heritage.
The president is encouraged about the progress that we are making with Mexico on border issues, and the president has said that America is a nation of immigrants and we should welcome people to our shores.
From Washington, D.C., this is Ravi D'Souza for Free Speech Radio News.
Virginia Beach is thinking about installing the surveillance equipment, now just an experiment in Tampa, Florida. But those living with the cameras think the random digitizing and database search of their faces is a violation of privacy. Nell Abram reports from Tampa.
Over 100 protesters wore a variety of masks as they walked through Tampa's Ybor City on Saturday night. Organized by the Tampa Bay Action Group, a collection of various church and activist organizations, they were looking to subvert the digital face scanning technology that lined the streets of the area's nightlife district. 2 months ago, the city council granted a one-year trial for the $30,000 technology designed to photograph and digitize the face of anyone chosen by police who's in the typical crowd of thousands on a given evening. Then the software would match up their face to a database of known criminals and missing children. On Thursday, the council plans to have a discussion open to the public and possibly reevaluate the face scanning system. In Tampa, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
And finally, the Pacifica Board of Directors is planning to hold an emergency conference call meeting in the hopes of electing 5 new board members. Pacifica, the oldest and largest listener-sponsored radio network in the country, is looking to replace board members who they say resigned after receiving heavy pressure at home and at work from loyal listeners. The list of 5 includes former Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry, comedian activist Dick Gregory, and former Michael Dukakis presidential campaign manager Susan Estrich. Leslie Kagan, one of the so-called dissident board members, says those currently controlling the board have not handled the issues honestly or fairly.
We also raise that concern that we, the National Board of Pacifica Radio, are mandated to have open public meetings. What plans are in place to make this conference call meeting an open public meeting? We think this is a gross violation of a mandate that we must respect.
Kagan was speaking today on Pacifica's program Democracy Now! Pacifica-owned and operated station KPFT in Houston did not air the broadcast. Pacifica critics say this is typical of Pacifica's censorship tactics. KPFT says they didn't air the show due to technical difficulties. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Russia and China are friends again. The two former communist countries signed a strategic friendship pact today to defend one another's interests and boost trade. The pact also effectively challenges the U.S. on its controversial plans for a missile defense shield. Both Russia and China say the good neighborly treaty of friendship and cooperation was in no way a military alliance. With more on the details of the pact, Phil Itner reports from Moscow.
The document signed by the two world leaders is considered the most far-reaching agreement between Russia and China in over half a century. The so-called Good Neighborly Treaty of Friendship and Cooperation is designed to improve diplomatic and economic ties between the two neighbors. The two presidents hastening to note it does not touch on military cooperation. Vladimir Putin said the agreement is not aimed at any third parties. Of course, this agreement most of all touches on our two nations, Russia and China, said Putin. But we presume it will also form the basis for stability in international relations as a whole. Both China and Russia have been vocal in their opposition to perceived American world dominance, saying that a multipolar world is the only way to ensure security. And both leaders have been outspoken in their criticism of the U.S. National Missile Defense Program. It is thought that this treaty, while not directly aimed against America, is an attempt to counter U.S. moves. Later in the week, Vladimir Putin travels to Genoa, Italy, for the G8 summit, where he will meet with American President George W. Bush. No doubt the Russian president will be carrying a message from this Sino-Russian summit, a message which many say will be a warning to the White House that there are international considerations the Americans should take into account when deciding current or future policy. Phil Itner, Free Speech Radio News, Moscow.
It's day two of the long-awaited India-Pakistan summit in Agra, India, where the two nuclear-armed adversaries continue to attempt to resolve differences over Kashmir, terrorism, and narcotics. The issue of security and nuclear defense has long been an obstacle to peace between the two nations, who have engaged in war over the disputed Himalayan province of Kashmir for over 50 years. Violence and terrorism continues as India blames Pakistan for arming and aiding militant Kashmir Muslims fighting for independence from India. Sonia Jabbar is with a movement in India for nuclear disarmament and a co-organizer of an alternative summit being held this week in India. Jabbar says the fact that both sides are talking again after a two-year gap is reason enough for hope, and she outlined the alternative summit's approach towards peace. We asked Jabbar about U.S. missile defense tests conducted over the weekend and the test's possible influence on resolving the differences between India and Pakistan.
We don't want nuclear weapons on the subcontinent. We feel they should be dismantled and destroyed. And that is in our declaration, because we've had the conference. We had it on Thursday. And in our final declaration, this was what we agreed. So over 250 organizations in India and Pakistan have agreed on this basic position.
Do you think that the fact that the U.S. was testing missiles over the weekend should make a difference in terms of India's position?
No, I don't believe that. I mean, in that sense, we're far more unilateral in that. We believe that we have to, you know, we want to pressure the United States to not do that, to not go ahead with the NMD program, to not go ahead with ballistic missile testing. But I mean, that doesn't mean that we, you know, we have to keep our nuclear weapons just because X, Y, and Z decide to keep their nuclear weapons, or to go ahead and develop nuclear weapons because X, Y, and Z are developing nuclear weapons. There's no end to this, you see.
Pakistan, China, Russia, they all have come out in opposition to missile defense. In fact, Russia and China, as late as today, made a joint statement of opposition. But India seems to, you know, has been supportive of this program. Why is that?
Well, it's very clear that there's a real attitude of I'll scratch your back and you scratch mine. You know, India wants acceptance into the nuclear club. It wants technology from the United States. It also wants America to lift sanctions. So it's really like, we have actually shifted our position on American nuclear weapons. I mean, this is a real shift when the Indian government endorsed the NMD. We've, done a 180-degree turnaround from what our position was for 50 years.
How is India's position on nuclear defense influencing the position between India and Pakistan?
Well, I think Pakistan sees this as India trying to win brownie points, which it is. I mean, this is the truth. I think Pakistan's position is far more honorable.
What is the alternative summit's solution to the decades-old dispute over Kashmir between India and Pakistan?
See, we're not talking about a solution as yet. What we want is an immediate cessation of hostilities from both sides. We want the war to stop. And I think in that, we reflect the sentiments of millions of people, both in India and Pakistan and in Kashmir. You know, you can't talk about solutions when you don't have a conducive situation. And you cannot have a conducive situation when you have someone's gun on your forehead. Our first demand is that all hostilities must cease immediately. That means Pakistan should stop or attempt to stop cross-border violence, or you call it terrorism, or you call it militancy, or call it what you will. But they must stop the jihadi groups from coming across the border. And India must agree to a phased withdrawal of troops. So this is our basic position. What we want is that any solution, any future solution on Kashmir between India and Pakistan must take into account the wishes of the people of Kashmir. This is very, very important. Whatever solution that they arrive at cannot be a sectarian solution. It must be a non-sectarian solution.
What role would you like to see the U.S. play in the India-Pakistan dispute over Kashmir?
Well, I think, actually, if they would stay out, it would be a wonderful role they'd be playing, because I mean, the way I see it is that they've done a great deal of harm in the last 54 years. It's been quite wonderful meeting friends from Pakistan over the last few years that I've been working on Pakistan-India relations and on Kashmir. And it's quite amazing how different it is from the official line. And you see, actually, what a destructive role the West has played in this situation.
Are there any final comments that you'd like to make that I haven't asked you about directly?
I think, countries like the United States have to start playing a more positive role. They cannot act in a unilateral fashion. I mean, the world is too small now, America is the number one arms exporting country in the world. This is shameful. You cannot be talking about world peace and wanting world peace when you have $55 billion of trade that you do in arms. The arms trade is something which actually fuels these conflicts around the world. And this is something that we have to recognize. A lot of people make a lot of money over this. So there's a lot of vested interest in keeping these conflicts alive. I would actually appeal to the people of America to join us, the people of India and the people of Pakistan, in our struggle for peace and for justice in the subcontinent.
Sonia Jabbar is with the Movement in India for Nuclear Disarmament, an organization established in 1998 after the resumption of nuclear tests between India and Pakistan. The Florida Supreme Court has upheld a ban on using state money for poor women's abortions. The justices rejected arguments made by abortion rights groups that the state unconstitutionally pressures women in its Medicaid program to choose childbirth over abortions that are medically necessary. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
The ruling by the Florida Supreme Court lets stand a state rule that prohibits state money from being spent on abortions, except in cases of rape or incest, or when it is necessary to save a woman's life. The ban mirrors the federal provision known as the Hyde Amendment, which bars using federal funds for abortions, with the same exceptions as the Florida law. Abortion rights activists claim that the policy essentially tells low-income women with such diseases as diabetes, lupus, and congenital heart disease that they are not entitled to Medicaid funding. Larry Spalding from the Florida ACLU was co-counsel on the case. He says the state court has again concurred that they will pay for an abortion if a woman's life is at stake, but not her health.
We're not talking now about elective abortions, abortions in which someone just makes a decision that they don't want to be pregnant. We're talking about a situation in which a physician says, for one reason or another, there is a medical reason for conducting the abortion. If you are indigent, that will not be reimbursed by Medicaid unless it is a result of rape, incest, or threatens the life, not the health, but the life of the mother.
The Center for Reproductive Law and Policy estimates that each year 7,000 Medicaid-eligible women in Florida fit the criteria of needing medically necessary abortions. Attorneys for the plaintiffs argued that the majority of states examining Medicaid coverage for medically necessary abortions have determined that such bans are unconstitutional and struck them down, including decisions in Texas, Indiana, and Arizona. But Larry Spalding from the ACLU says that argument was neutralized in the Florida Supreme Court.
This is a question, quite frankly, in which there are different rulings all around the country. It's one of those cases where we could clearly cite a number of state Supreme Courts which have ruled in our favor, and the defense was able to cite states in which the courts had ruled in their favor.
Abortion rights activists say the issue will undoubtedly wind its way back to the court. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
This week, hundreds of members of Operation Save America, formerly known as Operation Rescue, arrived in Wichita, Kansas for a week of protest and events in the city. They will be protesting and praying outside abortion clinics, progressive churches, and gay bars throughout the week in a renewal of the 1991 Summer of Mercy 10 years ago when they closed the Wichita clinics for 6 weeks. Miranda Kennedy is in Wichita with Operation Save America this week, and she files this in a series of reports.
Outside the clinic, which is fenced off by city police, pro-choice activists had some vocal confrontation with Operation Save America as the anti-abortion group kicked off their week of Wichita events at Dr. George Tiller's abortion clinic. The clinic, Women's Healthcare Services, is infamous among anti-choice activists. It is one of only a handful of clinics in the country that performs extremely late-term, third-trimester abortions. And today, pro-choice activists are especially on guard after the only clinic in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was burned to the ground yesterday. No one was injured, but police are investigating the possibility of arson. Although Dr. Tiller's clinic was closed for the weekend, Operation Save America began their siege on the clinic on Saturday with a 24-hour vigil and a staggered fast outside. Vinnie Bosco is a born-again Christian who traveled from Connecticut to attend OSA's demonstrations.
We come to protest this abortion clinic right here, hopefully to bring it down once and for all. This man provides late-term abortions and also partial birth abortions. He claims to be the best abortionist in the world, late-term abortionist.
Operation Save America's call to action proclaims they will finish the work they began in Wichita 10 years ago, but organizers say they will not organize the mass clinic blockades that became Operation Rescue's trademark in the 1980s. Last week, Wichita Mayor Bob Knight took a hard line against the protesters, declaring that anyone who interfered with the clinic would be arrested immediately. Although local OSA leaders assure authorities that events this week will be peaceful, the city can hardly forget their last visit in 1991, when a total of 2,700 arrests were made. Wichita activist Steve Otto was organizing against Operation Rescue, and he remembers those 6 weeks well.
The city officials, yeah, I mean, some of them who were not sympathetic to Tiller or the clinics, but these guys were taking over the town. Bob Knight was the mayor at the time. And even he's a Republican, and he may even be pro-life, but these people were basically destroying the whole economic lifeline of the city. They were disrupting a lot of things, and he couldn't sit by and do nothing. He had to get the police in their full force and eventually clear these people out.
The small pro-choice community in conservative Wichita was taken off guard by OSA's tactics 10 years ago. But Otto says the local pro-choice movement has matured a great deal since then, in part because of OSA's descent on their town. At the invitation of the Wichita Choice Alliance, pro-choice activists from around the country have come to Kansas to counter OSA. Members of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice promise a daily peaceful presence outside Dr. Tiller's clinic.
We're religious people too, and one thin line of fanaticism does not have the only word on how to get to God and how to live in God. And so we're here to represent the majority of America, and the majority of religious America are pro-choice, surveys have shown. And not only do we support women, but we support the traditions and the churches they come from.
Monica Corsaro, a Methodist pastor from Seattle. Pastors at many of Wichita's progressive churches sermonized in favor of reproductive choice at yesterday's services. Outside each of those churches yesterday, Operation Save America protesters appeared in what they call truth trucks, large wagons plastered with graphic pictures of aborted fetuses, waving pro-life signs at the local congregants. Rick Miller is a local Operation Save America supporter who left his job as a concrete truck driver when he was asked to deliver to Women's Health Services Clinic several years ago. Miller, who participated in the 1991 protests, says ending abortion in the U.S. has been a longer road than activists expected it to be, but he is confident that they will end abortion at Dr. Tiller's clinic this time with the word of the gospel.
I just couldn't be a part of helping to build this house. I'm trying to build the house of the Lord, and I saw it as blood money, and I didn't want anything to do with it. I believe I made the better choice. Choice to stand up for life.
Pro-life activists were outside Dr. Tiller's clinic at 6:30 this morning and plan to rally and march through the city later today. Pro-choice forces swear to counter them every morning throughout the week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Wichita.
In Oakland, California, city officials are set to approve a $50,000 settlement to the family of an unarmed African-American Oakland man who was shot and killed by city police. Nathan Horn was shot once in the chest on December 5, 1999. The shooting happened as Horn made a hard left turn and stepped onto the accelerator. The officer who shot Horn says he thought Horn was going to run him over. The city of Oakland has paid out more than $500,000 this year alone in settlements related to excessive force, negligence, or wrongful arrest by the Oakland Police Department. In another Oakland police misconduct case, Judge Leo Dorado ruled that several former Oakland police officers known as the Riders will stand trial for police misconduct. The officers stand charged for 34 counts ranging from filing false police reports to assault and kidnappings. Mitch Jeserich reports from Oakland.
In a month-long preliminary court hearing, rookie police officer Keith Batt testified to extreme police misconduct and brutality by his training officers. Known as the Riders, Chuck Mabinog, Jude Siapno, and Matthew Hornung are facing charges ranging from planting drugs on suspects to kidnappings and falsifying police reports. A fourth member, Francisco Vasquez, is believed to have fled to Mexico. The prosecuting deputy district attorney, David Hollister, says he is looking forward to the trial. He says the illegal acts by these veterans, cops, who trained rookie officers, held the potential for generations of police misconduct.
There was a significant amount of testimony establishing that from the chief on down, there was a lot of instruction given to the officers on the streets to go out and do proactive law enforcement, particularly to eradicate the drug use and dealing on the streets of Oakland.
But Hollister feels that Riders' illegal acts are the exception and not the norm within the Oakland Police Department. He says he too supports aggressive police action, but the officers on trial went beyond aggressive tactics and broke the law. Ed Fishman is the defense attorney for Matthew Hornung. Fishman says the Riders' aggressive tactics are encouraged by the Oakland Police Department, and the Riders were doing what was expected of them.
What was occurring here was not only illegal acts by these officers, but two of these officers, one of which is currently in warrant status and not before the court, but two of these officers were field training officers. meaning part of their job was to train new officers. The unfortunate part was, at least during the 2 weeks that we've been able to proceed on, during those 2 weeks, rookie officers were trained to do these illegal acts by at least one of the defendants.
After a series of police misconduct cases have become public, including the shooting death of an African-American undercover cop last year, Oakland community members are losing confidence in the police. John Melendrez has lived in Oakland for 35 years. He says though police harassment has always existed in his neighborhood, it has become worse since Jerry Brown was elected mayor in 1998.
It has never been worse than these last 2 years. It's like unbelievable. We're living like an occupied town, police state. It's my house has been raided and searched maybe 12 times in the last 2 years. I'm not a drug dealer. It seems like a push that they want to get rid of the poor people in East Oakland, as in West Oakland, and try to make way for the money people, which Brown is supporting. Brown, when he got into office, he said that he was going to eliminate all these police officers from out of town. Well, I think he should eliminate himself.
Mayor Brown, former governor of California in the 1970s, has been trying to change the image of Oakland to attract new businesses and residents. Richard L. Word is the chief of the Oakland Police Department. He says he's listening to the community so to convey their message back to his officers. However, Chief Word used the writers as an example of the Oakland Police Department internally combating police misconduct.
This writers case, that West Oakland scandal, I mean, we were alerted to it internally. I mean, so we learned of this ongoing, this misconduct, and we responded quickly. We put these officers in administrative leave, suspended their police officer powers, launched our internal investigation. We referred the case to the DA's office. They launched the criminal investigation, and these officers were charged, and most recently this week they were held to answer, and now they have to stand trial. And so I would hope people would look at that too and say, you know, they apparently something's right, because they didn't cover it up. They went public with it. And so I hope that would inspire some confidence in us.
Michelle Alexander from the American Civil Liberties Union says police brutality and racial profiling stems from a larger cultural and political system that perceives men of color as criminals.
Since the war on drugs began about two decades ago, communities of color have been systematically targeted for repression and mass incarceration. And that's really what racial profiling is all about. It's the singling out of individuals and communities on the basis of race for the purpose of sweeping them into the criminal justice system.
The ACLU sponsors a national hotline number for victims of racial profiling. That number is 1-877-392-7867. Once again, that's 1-877-392-7867. For Free Speech News in Oakland, I'm Mitch Jezerich.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.